now is I am my beloved and He is mine. In other words, there is a realization that I'm His first before He is mine. As a young Christian, we always say, He is mine, I found Him. As we grow in the Lord, we say, I'm His, He found me. It's a realization, there's a deeper relationship with God that we have. And it's in this fourth stage that she also declares in chapter 7, verse 10. She declares here, I am my beloved's, and His desire is toward me. The word mine completely disappears. All the focus is now Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. Not even one thought of self. What a marvelous. See, by the time we partake of the sufferings of Jesus and die on the cross of Calvary, like Paul, you begin to say, I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. It began to be so dead to yourself that even your consciousness is Jesus, 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 what do you want? Jesus, how do I please you? Jesus, your desire is mine. Jesus, Jesus, you, I'm yours and your desire is towards me. It's now a very deep relationship. Your consciousness is completely of the Lord. And it's at that stage that the beloved begins to describe the bride. In chapter 7, verse 1, how beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince daughters. The curls of your thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a skillful workman. So he begins to describe the Shulamite. And the fourth section is found in Ephesians 5, 28 and 29. It says, so husbands ought to love their own wives as their own body. See, His desire is now ours. And His desire is for us. In other words, the body and the bridegroom becomes one. It says here, husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it. You begin to see that the Lord cherishing His bride. His bride is now the center of His desire. It's a perfect bride. A perfect bride. That brings us to the final fifth section in chapter 8, verse 5, right to the ending. It's a final short fifth section. And you notice in the fifth section, it talks about death. See, in verse 6, it says, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is as strong as death, jealousy as cruel as a grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. He's talking about love is as strong as death. In chapter 5, we see the unification of the bride with the bridegroom. She is a seal upon his heart and a seal upon his arm. By the fifth section, the bride and the bridegroom are really caught up above. The rapture has taken place. How do we mark the rapture in this book? Do you notice there are two times when he talks about his left hand and his right hand? The first time is when Jesus comes first into our life in the first section. That is in chapter 2, verse 6. at the end of the first section, chapter 2, verse 6, it says, His left hand is under my head, and His right hand embraces me. It's supposed to be a position of intimacy. That symbolizes His coming for us, His first coming. And it's not repeated again until the end of the fourth section, when He comes again for us. In chapter, looking over at chapter 8, verse 3, the second time, His left hand is under my head, and His right arm embraces me. You know this? Now the second time, because it's the glorious bride that He comes to receive. And by the fifth section, we are already taken to be with Him, sealed up in the heavenly places. We have walked through the valley of the shadow of death. We have overcome death. And we have passed the gateway of death. Our bodies have been transformed. And this mortal body has put on immortality. And the corrupt body has put on incorruptible newness in God. So that spirit, soul and body, we are united with Him. And that fifth section ties up with Ephesians chapter 5, verse 30. Ephesians 5, verse 30. For we are members of His body, of His flesh, and of His bones. Didn't the fifth section declare, set me as a seal on your heart. Set me as a seal on your arm. In other words, I don't want to be just separated and holding your hand. I want to be so a part of your heart and be so much your flesh, your bone, your very tissues. That's a fifth section. We become the members of His flesh and His body because He translates us and we receive a new body in Him. So the Song of Solomon is a song of the church and Jesus Christ, the bridegroom. Now there's one final section in Ephesians that we have not touched here that relates to Song of Solomon 2, which is Ephesians chapter 5, verse 31 and 32, which goes into our third interpretation of the Song of Solomon. As I mentioned, there are three approaches. You could take the literal, where every place that they go is a literal place, and every plan or thing that they say is a literal one. You could take number two, which we have done, is an allegory of love between the believer and the Lord of the church and Jesus Christ. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 31-32. It says, For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Now, in Christianity, we have seen how in nearly 2,000 years of Christianity, Christians have debated over the relationship of men and women. Christians have moved from one end of the pendulum where they have regarded, and we are talking about Ephesians chapter 5, verse 31-32. And we are talking about the sexual relationship between a man and a woman. Things that people seldom preach on, teach on. In fact, if I ask any of you, have you ever heard a sermon on that area? Some of you say, no, never. Only in a marriage seminar or something like that. But the Bible is very explicit and clear on this area. And here I will share with you my struggles as I look into the Bible. I'm aware and not ignorant of the fact that in the secular world, both of classical books and traditional books of the heathens, like certain religion, they have the Kama Sutra and they talk about the sexual aspects of relationship, or the Chinese books by one emperor so and so, forgot the emperor's name, and then we have this 1960s sexual revolution, and then we have, and we Christians struggle with the ethics here. The ethics hasn't changed, but we struggle with the information and the technology that we confront. We want to find a theological balance in it. And Christians have swung from one end of the pendulum. See, on one end of the pendulum, Christians have always, and some people give the impression that sexual relationship is sinful and it's wrong and it's evil. And that's from the past. And here we are in what we call in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and now we're into the 90s. We have nearly three decades of the sexual revolution, and the only thing wrong with it is it's immoral. And there's lack of morals and lack of ethics, but yet there are a lot of information. But I'm a pastor and I speak as a pastor, alright? Now if you feel, if you don't want me to go into this thing, then for additional tips. But here is where, as a pastor, I realize as we counsel and we marry people in the church, here is this problem. The parents of the new of the fiancés, of the newly to be weds, never give them counseling on family planning or anything to do in those areas. They go to see the doctors and the gynecologists, and unless they ask, and even if they ask, sometimes the gynecologists give them technical and professional answers, so that there is no real counseling, but just answering scientific questions. And the problem, even though, imagine we are living in a computer technological age, and yet our handling, we handle computers, we handle science, the new concept in science and new discoveries in science, and we wrestle with it, like the discovery of quarks and tops and downs and up quark and down quark and things that make the proton and the neutron, etc. We wrestle with that. Then when it comes to wrestling with information on sex and all these areas, we are like in the 18th century. We are like 20th century people using the tools of the 20th century, but stuck in some areas of our life in the 18th century, and we don't know how to approach it. And that is sad. And as we marry people, I realize this thing, that if nobody counsel the newlyweds in this area that we are going to consider here, that the Bible speaks about, who will? Do you know the majority of people get their answers from their friends, who are sometimes also not so expert? It's like the blind leading the blind. And so they're too shy to ask anywhere, so they go for the books. There are so many books out there in the market, and you don't know which is which. And it's only in these past few decades of Christianity, and most of the books are not by Asians, they are by Westerners, who, because of the research of sexologists like Master and Johnson and Dr. Hyde, etc., not the Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but the H-I-T-E, Hyde, that the Christians have started writing in this area, and given Christians and churches guidelines how to handle this new information and to wrestle with it from the biblical background. Now, we stand against pornography, we stand against immorality, we stand against things that break the Ten Commandments and ethics and anything that breaks down a family relationship. However, we must be open to information.